first of all, I want to say hello. Thank you. It's good to see everyone here. And thanks for coming to the talk. I know this is a long day for a lot of us, or maybe you're just dipping in for a particular segment, and I'm happy to see you here. I'm very honored to be a part of the Business Innovation Leadership Technology Conference for ISA Global, and hopefully this will be something interesting. So as was mentioned, my topic is sustainable software systems, and it's about meeting the challenge for the future. And I want to do this in a slightly unusual way. I actually want to do this telling some stories. I want to introduce you to some notions that actually go back to the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, a thing called the triple bottom line as a way to create sustainability in technology. And I want to sort of illustrate this through a series of little stories and images. Before I get into that, I just want to say this is me. This is how you find me on LinkedIn and GitHub and YouTube and Twitter, and I would love to connect with you, learn more about what you're doing and what you're working on, what's challenging for you in the space of technology, services, and architecture and APIs and all that kind of stuff. So please feel free to connect with me. If you can, remind me that we're ISA Global buddies and friends, and I'd be happy to connect. So as I said, I want to start talking about this idea of sustainable software and sustainable software systems. I really want to talk about the larger picture of not just one piece of software, not just one component, but an entire system, like an autonomous vehicle, but thinking, you know, in a global sense. So there are lots of ways that we already know about things about sustainability, energy, services, even the idea of the green sustainable software model has been very popular. There's a great book that focuses on agile software practices to create sustainable software development by Kevin Tate. I love this book. So these all talk about, you know, relatively specific elements, energy use, recycling and reuse, the idea of designing a model that reuses code, the idea of creating software that's sustainable over time. I want to kind of step back a little bit and talk not just about the software, but also the people involved in creating the software and using the software, and our impact on the planet itself. So the devices that we make, the disposable phones that we create, what's recyclable and what's not, the amount of electricity that we generate or demand when we're trying to generate software, and how it affects the profit overall of your particular organization, and also the profit availability for organizations in general. To think about it very simply, if expenses continue to rise for everyone, then the opportunity for profit decreases for everyone, whether that everyone is everyone in your organization, all your competing companies in a particular marketplace, and the world itself. So it's important for us to think about this ability to sustain whatever we're working on. Now, as I mentioned, I want to do this through a little bit of storytelling. I want to introduce you to Alex Rivera. Alex is a comics artist. He's a very talented artist. And he has helped me by creating some drawings and some renderings that will help illustrate several points along the way. And that's where this particular drawing comes from, this idea of Omniterra. These are places that we'll visit during the next 45 minutes or so to kind of illustrate the issues of people, profit, and planet, and how sustainability works. We won't get a chance to visit all these locations in this particular talk, and if you're interested, if you follow my channel, you can see a few more of them, but I thought this would be a great way to actually create a little bit of interest. I'm going to go ahead and then focus directly on the slides now. You don't need to be looking at me as we continue. So actually, I want to start our trip through Omniterra in a place called the Ruins of Monolithia. This is probably the last place you'd think to begin the journey, but it really is the start of most of our conversations about sustainability. And you might recognize this particular place in your own life, in your own organizations. This was a vastly successful society, and it had very interesting, their rulers were architects, were physical architects. That's how you became a ruler in Monolithia. And what would happen is every architect that came to power would establish their own architectural style, and they would create make over the entire community in their architectural style. And of course, the community grew over time. And as each architect ascended to the throne, and they would start to make over things, they would rebuild things. Things were not working online. They would add some things. They would remove some things. And then pretty soon, as we got all through time over and over, more and more parts of Monolithia were not working properly. They were in progress. They used to work fine, but they didn't match the new ruler's architecture. So she would make it into something else. So we would build more and more. And then more and more of the community became non-functional. It was like a construction zone in lots and lots of places, and parts didn't fit and didn't work together. But then we would have a new ruler, and then that new ruler would overmake everything else and then say, we're going to build everything again, until finally at one point, so many rulers had come to power, so many changes had been made, so many pieces had been started and rebuilt over and over, that nothing worked anymore. It was a non-functional community. You couldn't use the roads, you couldn't use the buildings, you couldn't use the housing, nothing worked. And eventually, people left, and they left this structure, this hulk of what used to be this amazing and burgeoning city. And this is what happens when we keep trying to rebuild over and over and over again. And this is really where we can start our journey in talking about sustainability. So there's this report called Our Common Future, which was commissioned by the World Commission on Environment and Development in the late 80s. And then Prime Minister of Norway, Gro Harlem Brundtland, led this committee and created this report, which is simply known today as Our Common Future, which is a great book, a little book that I'd encourage you to read. And it lays out this notion of sustainable development and what that is at a planetary level, not just at an IT level. And basically, it's this idea that development meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And there are lots of ways you can think about this. You can think about this in terms of using up valuable resources. What are future generations going to be doing? You can think about this notion of ensuring that there's enough resources of all types, or accessibility to resources of all types. You can think about equality, about living conditions, about healthcare. You can think about it in lots and lots of different ways. This idea of sustainability in general actually goes back a very long way. And for example, there's this book from basically the 17th century, the book called Silva. This gentleman by the name of John Evelyn, who was talking about the notion of how we're going to need to manage the trees of the forest because they're our fuel. So we need to actually come up with a management plan for forest trees. And it is because of this book, this notion of managing forest trees, that we use the word in English, forestry, as the idea of managing timber and managing trees and so on and so forth. So this is really something that we've thought about for quite a long time. Here's the challenge. It can be difficult to foresee what the future is going to be like. So we have to kind of imagine what's going on. We have to imagine what kind of software we're going to need, what kind of things are going to be difficult to sustain, and what kinds of demands are going to be made on us in the future. So the question is, how do we plan for the unknown? When I talk to organizations about designing their software architecture, I usually try to tell them, you're trying to design a system that's going to be used by people you've never met to solve problems you've never thought about. That's sustainability. That's the ability to use, reuse, and solve new problems. Now, you might be familiar with this gentleman. His name is Mel Conway. There's actually a Conway's Law that has been named after him. And Mel has this great quote. Every time a delegation is made and somebody's scope of inquiry is narrowed, the class of alternatives that can be pursued is now also narrowed. In other words, when you make a decision, you've just cut off a whole bunch of options for the future that are now not available to you. So it's really important when we think about this challenge of the future and creating something that's sustainable, that we are careful about what we decide. This often in our own lives, if you're a software architect or even any kind of IT job, this often manifests itself as deciding too early. or over-engineering, or all these other steps that make decisions before you have the full story. And here, now you've made a decision, and all sorts of options are no longer available to you. There's another great way to approach this. Tom and Mary Papandikou, who brought lean manufacturing to the software movement, have this great line in their book, Implementing Lean Software. Delay commitment until the last responsible moment. It's a moment at which failing to make a decision eliminates an important alternative. That's really difficult for a lot of us to do. And that notion of delaying your decision until you really have to make it. But that is the key to creating flexible, sustainable systems over time, is to make sure you put off that decision because of what Conway says, because Mel says, as soon as you decide, you close off alternatives. Tom and Mary Papandikou say, don't make that decision until the last responsible moment. And I think that's a really, really good lesson. So I think one of the first lessons in sustainability is this notion that time is actually an architectural element. Time is something that we have to deal with, and it's something that's really, really important. We grow our architecture by going through time. So going through time is very important, and that leads to the next location that I want to take us to in our little visit to Omniterra, and that is the Caves of Persis. The Caves of Persis are very, very interesting. They're these vast caves where everyone from the cities brings all their material to be stored. They own lots and lots of things. Celebration material for different holidays of the year, special family heirlooms, things that they've acquired over time, and they don't have room for all of it. So they bring their materials to be stored by the monks in the Caves of Persis. And the monks store everything in the locations wherever they need to. And the challenge that the monks have is they have to remember where everything is. So everything gets its place and it gets organized in some kind of way. But as more and more things are brought in, the monks know exactly where things are placed. And it turns out no single organizational element or no single way of organizing information is good enough. There will always be some kind of change behind the scenes. But exactly where in the caves these items are stored is not interesting to all the citizens. They have an identifier, they have a piece of paper, they say, I need my celebratory urn, I need my chairs, I need my pots and pans. And they'll use that ID to go find. So it's really, really sort of a metaphor for the way we store things over time. And what's really interesting is they never get rid of anything. They keep things and they move it into cold storage or some other place that's far away. They put it in a place that doesn't get traffic so much anymore, because you never know when you're going to need something. So this is a key element in sustainability as well. This notion of being able to have this flexible storage, this flexible way to identify and retrieve information. And that's really what we're doing a lot today when we're doing our online services. When you look at AWS storage and so on and so forth, they're creating these vast caves, these locations where things get stored. And it doesn't really matter physically where they are, as long as they're available. And there's a lot we can learn from planning on how we store things and how we know what's valuable and what's not, and how to find them over time. And that really leads to the first leg of this idea of people, profit, planet. So I want to introduce John Elkington at this time in the story. John Elkington wrote this book. He had been involved in the Common Future with Gro Harlem Brundtland, and he wrote this book called Cannibals with Forks about how to realize the kinds of sustainability that the Brundtland Commission was talking about. And the story behind Cannibals with Forks is really, really interesting. So he had noticed that in the 80s and 90s, companies were kind of cannibalizing each other. They were buying each other out. They were getting bigger and bigger without really thinking about their effects on anything. And he was basically saying, are cannibals any more advanced if they eat with forks? And that's sort of a reference to the idea of the book. But the fork is also a reference to his triple bottom line idea, TBL. And he says he focuses on the economic, not just the economic value you add, but also the environmental and social value that you add or remove. And that's a really, really interesting way to think about it. So the way that Elkington encourages corporations to think about this is to actually constantly weigh and constantly balance your costs and revenues, your consumptions and your outputs, and your employee welfare and your contributions to society. So these are all three key elements. And organizations like Nike and Walmart and Microsoft and all these other organizations have signed on to this triple bottom line plan. And really, what it talks about is the difference between effective and efficient. So often it can be very efficient to whittle out the middleman, middleware services, the intermediaries, so that you work directly with the customer. But when you remove intermediaries, you're removing jobs from the system. You're affecting the community. It can be very efficient to have a large store like Walmart in the community, but it can actually destroy lots of other small shops along the way. It can be very efficient to have one giant database in one place where you store it, but as soon as you do that, now you have a huge central failure point in the system. So effective and efficient are not always the same. I can take a moment here to say we've learned over the last 9 months that effective and efficient are definitely at odds with each other when it comes to the pandemic. We have lots of efficient elements that are no longer effective in this day and age. So often there's a conflict between these two items. Now, the good news is we navigate effective and efficient constantly every day. And in fact, there's a great book by Eric Holnagel called The Efficiency Thoroughness Trade-Off. So he talks about the difference between being super efficient and being super thorough. And it's the principle that it's never possible to maximize both efficiency and thoroughness at the same time. We get into habits of doing things in certain ways. We design software in certain ways. We buy products that help us solve our problem in familiar ways. They're not always the most efficient, but they might be very thorough. They might be very effective. So the trade-off is really, really important. What we use often when we design our software, when we solve our problems, are models. And I love this quote from George Box. George Box says, "All models are wrong, but some are useful." And that's very, very true in real life. It's really important to remember that the map is not the territory, right? So there's this joke by, I forget, a comedian by the name of Wright. I don't remember his first name. But he said, "I have a map of the world. It's life size, but it's really hard to fold." Right? So we know how silly that sounds, right? But all maps are just approximations. All models are just approximations. When we're trying to figure out how to be effective or efficient, we use some kind of model somewhere. Now, I've been quoted several times as saying, when it comes to data, when it comes to IT systems, your data model is not the same as your object model or your resource or your message model. It's not really important that we understand all of the lingo, but the point is models change over time, and models are just as useful as the people who are actually using them. So it's really important to think about this notion of how efficiency and modeling and what we decide is profit is really thought of. And that's a really, really important lesson to learn in our story. So we talk about this idea of what might be profit and how we model our incomes and outputs. I want to take us to another spot in the map, and that is the Scholars of Agrigato, and talk about what's happening there. So there's this square in our Omniterra where all of these really, really smart people go, and they have all these booths. It's sort of like a marketplace. It's a hustle and bustle marketplace, and all of these scholars are super, super brilliant at one particular thing: computing a distance, measuring a temperature, manufacturing an item, so on and so forth. But the thing is, they're super good at one thing. They do one thing, and they do one thing well. And that's all they do. And it turns out, in order to solve any particular problem, you need to visit with lots of these scholars one after another in order to get a solution put together. It turns out you can't decide or define or solve a particular problem with just one scholar. You need multiple scholars in the process. There is one other hitch that's really, really kind of amazing about the Scholars of Agrigato. They can solve a problem, but they have no long-term memory of that solution. In other words, if you ask them a question, you ask them to solve a particular measurement, a net cost present value or something like that, and they'll answer immediately, and then they'll forget who you are. And you have to introduce yourself again and again and again. So the scholars of Agrigato don't actually remember each other or remember you. They just keep, they're like savants. They're experts at one particular thing and one thing only. But they make an amazing community. It turns out these scholars, the way they sort of deliver their information is in a kind of a dance. It's a kind of a choreographed dance. And it's called the Dance of Knowing. Now, this leads us to the next pillar in the triple bottom line, and that is people. So there's been several studies about how social capital and the quality of life and the health of the community and the available resources in the community affect the profitability of businesses. If we have people who are not healthy, if we have people who are not well-educated, if we have people who are struggling to get by day after day, businesses in that community have a difficult time continuing and being profitable. It turns out the notion of supporting a community is an efficiency throw in this trade-off itself for businesses. And I love this quote from former President Barack Obama. And he was talking to a bunch of Silicon Valley investors and architects, and he was telling them basically that government will never run like Silicon Valley because you have to serve all of the people. I can't just find a market and go solve that market's problem. As he said, my market is the entire country. And when you think about it in lots of other ways, our market can be the entire planet. And there's lots of messiness involved there. You can't get too efficient. You can't just segment off one little piece of the population to be successful. The government's job is dealing with the problems that nobody else wants to deal with. That means basically those non-profitable elements. And that's a real key element. So I had mentioned earlier that these savants have this dance of knowing, this way of explaining things. And that dance of knowing is very beautiful. It's fantastic to view and watch. But it's also a reminder that we're all connected in fundamental ways, that the organizations you run inside your company have their own life on their own, especially for multinational organizations. As you cross boundaries, as you cross from one continent to another, one country, one language to another, you're really talking about connected communities. And those connected communities have their own kinds of challenges. A colleague of mine, Ronnie Mitra, who works for Sapient Publicis in London, we wrote a book together about microservices, and he had this great observation. How we structure the company, the way we communicate with each other, really has an impact on what we build. And it's kind of a version of what Mal Conway has said before. So the way we structure our organization, the way we structure ourselves inside our community is going to affect our profitability, our success. And here's the Mel Conway quote that many of you may have heard before. Organizations which design systems produce designs which are copies of the way they communicate. Now, it's a simple line, but it's also a rather deep idea. And that is the idea that the way we treat others is the output we get. So it turns out the group, whether it's a team or whether it's a whole organization, the group is more important than any one individual. We know this idea already. Some of us have had the pleasure of working on high-performance teams. And what happens in these high-performance teams is their collective value, their collective output, their collective intelligence is greater than just the sum of the parts. There's something else magical that happens. We talk about chemistry or all sorts of other things. But this has an even deeper and stronger meaning when it comes to sustainability. The group gets its characteristics from the individuals that make up the group. So that means if I change membership of the group, then that group changes in a fundamental way. In other words, just replacing me with another person isn't going to make it the same group. It's a different group. And each time you make changes, that's a different group. And this reminds me of the Theseus paradox. Theseus, the story of Theseus is that he traveled the seas in a ship, and it took him years and years. And along the way, he had to repair his ship over and over, so he kept replacing some wood, some planks, a sail, a mast, so on and so forth. By the time he returned, he had replaced every single part of that ship. So the question is that the same ship he left with, or is this a new ship? So the Theseus paradox teaches us this notion that we're always changing, that change is inevitable. Change is actually a feature, and our communities change all the time. We're not participating in or building static systems. We're building dynamic systems. When we talk about sustainability, we're not talking about creating something that's fixed over time. We're actually talking about something that changes constantly over time. And that's a really important lesson as well in this ability to think about sustainability in the triple bottom line. So I want to visit another location in this story, and that is the Valley of the Metaphors. This is a very, very peculiar part of our map, part of our world. In the Valley of the Metaphors, there are these giant sculptures. In these sculptures, nobody knows how they got there. Nobody knows who put them there. Nobody knows anything about the sculptors or the community that built them. But what they do know is that they change over time, ever so slowly. If you stand and sit and watch, nothing seems to really change. But if you come back 3 months later or 4 months later, the sculptures have actually changed in fundamental ways. They change their shape. They change their location. And nobody knows quite how that happens or why that is. But these things morph all the time. And that really leads us to the third element in our triple bottom line, and that is the planet itself. So one of the things that Elkington talks about in his book is that we want to benefit from natural order as much as possible and minimize our impact. And this works in software as well. We want to actually change or rearrange as little as possible. We don't want to end up like Monolithia, where we're constantly breaking things or constantly rebuilding things. What we want to do is have as little impact on the sustainability, the fundamental foundation of things, and get the most value out of that is along the way. And that sort of acknowledges this notion of natural order. Usually people are pretty good in thinking about the notion of natural order in biology or nature, but they're not really ready to think of a natural order for their IT systems. In fact, that's what Mel Conway and Ronnie Mitra are constantly talking about. There is a natural order of things. There is a way we all do things. That is the culture. Culture is the way we do things here. That's why I have to learn culture when I join your organization. We all have a natural order. And the Brundtland Commission focused on this as well. The environment is where we live, and development is what we're trying to do to improve that environment. The two are inseparable. There's an old joke by two Australian commentators. There was an oil spill in Australia, not a funny thing, but there was an oil spill, and they were sort of mimicking what was going on in the news media. And one of the people said, "Well, there is no oil spill. We've towed the tanker out of the environment. It's no longer in the environment." And of course, that's a silly notion, right? We're always in the environment, and that's exactly what our IT systems are like. The system is not just the hardware, not just the software. It's the people, it's the locations, it's the building, it's everything. All we can do is alter or nudge the existing system. We don't create new systems. We can add to it, but we're inseparable from the actual system in which it's all running. And this notion of being inseparable, of having this connection, Mel Conway calls it this archaeology of software over the decades. I work in lots of organizations where they're running mainframes. They've run them for 30 or 40 years and they work perfectly fine. This is a history. This is a connection to the past. The Great Law of the Iroquois talks about this notion of seven generations of stewardship. When they think about their ability to affect the environment, they try to think seven generations ahead. They're thinking 150 years ahead. What's possible, what decision they're making today, and how that's going to affect the future. This takes us all the way back to the way we were talking in the beginning about affecting the future. So change is rarely a discrete jump. Often it's very, very slow. We don't really realize over time how much change is really going on. I think we've all had this experience. We work on an IT project and it's very exhilarating, and we finish it up and we leave it and we move on. And then we come back a year or so later and we look at it, and parts of it aren't even recognizable anymore. It turns out they've changed in fundamental ways. They're still working, they're still doing their job, but they're different. So the real question is, how can things which seem solid or seem static actually change? What's really going on? Well, it turns out that they change at a micro level, at a microscopic level. Our skin, our body is a system. Our skin completely replaces, I think, every couple of years or something. I can't remember what the number is. But we don't think of it. We don't see that level of change. One of the ways that we're starting to see levels of change inside our organization is this notion of microservices. And microservices allow us to change systems faster, is the way Sam Gibson talks about it. Changing faster may be a good thing as long as it isn't environmentally harmful, and that environment includes our IT system. In other words, we always want to work out new ways of cooperating with our customers, our suppliers, and our stakeholders, whoever they may be, inside the organization or outside the organization. For most of us, with the changes that have been going on in the way IT operates, the role it plays in our companies, those of us who are in charge of infrastructure and architecture are actually the ones who are the keepers of the environment, the key elements that can help sustain the organization. We have to learn and teach cooperation among all sorts of stakeholders in the process. So it's really important that we think about it in this way, that our job is to maintain the health of the existing system, not try to replace it and build a new one, but to maintain what we already have. And that leads us to the last place I wanted to take us on this trip. And that place is what I call Mount Roy. Mount Roy is this amazing peak all the way at the top. And it's this journey that everyone in Monolithia wants to try to make. They want to go ahead and have this experience of climbing to the top of Mount Roy, because up at the top, there's this great sage, this really, really brilliant man that's supposed to have all the answers to everything. And they call him Roy. His name is Roy. And he has this huge canoe, this huge boat, this large boat that he says he's putting everything inside. The world lives inside. Everyone works together inside this giant metaphysical canoe. And people want to go on this journey to get to the top of the mountain. The problem is the journey takes a lifetime. It takes forever. And it turns out people get tired along the way. One of the things that happens is they get partway up the journey and they sort of convince themselves that they've gotten far enough. This is as far as we can go. And they kind of set up shop. And then as other seekers come up and up the path, they try to waylay them. They try to sell them an idea. They try to say, there's nothing up ahead. You don't need to worry about it. Everything you need, I can sell you. I can give to you. So what happens is the trip to this peak, the trip to this place is not only arduous, it also gets treacherous, because there are places along the way where you can get waylaid or sidestepped along the way. So this notion of sustainability, this idea of working to balance the people, profit, and planet, the way our organizations work, the impact that our software has on different people, is really all about this notion of sustainability. And it's a long path. It takes a long time. And we can get sidetracked sometimes. Sometimes we need to take a break and take a rest. But the idea is that we always want to be working toward this notion of sustainability. And that sustainability will improve the profit of our organization, reduce the cost of operating our systems, reduce the negative impact that we have on our employees, on our employees' community, and on the planet around us. So the more we focus on these ideas, the more we focus on this ability to create sustainable systems, the better off we're going to be. Now, I love this quote from Donella Meadows. Donella Meadows is famous for systems thinking. She has a book called Systems Thinking, which I think is fantastic. She was also involved in a project called Limits to Growth, where she helped build in the 70s and 80s, the very first computerized models of sustainable impact on the planet. And she really helps establish kind of the technology and the math and the thinking around this idea of how we decide where our limits to growth are. And she's got this wonderful line: running the same system harder or faster will not change the pattern unless the structure is revised or changed. So trying harder, running faster, working longer hours, throwing more money at the existing problem isn't going to fix it. Often we have to change our thinking. We have to change the way we think about what our problem is and then focus on solutions that make sense. So what does that really mean for us? What does that mean if you're operating an IT organization? So the first thing is, when it comes to that profit element, whether it's you're trying to reduce costs inside your IT organization, or you're trying to create revenue opportunities using IT, focus on value, not just profit. A lot of organizations I'm talking to now are very openly talking about the notion of value exchange. What am I exchanging for what I'm getting? What am I offering people? What do I get in return? A lot of times, the profit today in IT is actually the behavior information I get when you're using my app, whether it's your name, your friends, how often you're online, where you are in your location when you take a photo, so on and so forth. That becomes the value exchange. So there's lots of value exchanges. Focus on value, not just raw profit. Actually, just getting the data is one thing, but using it in a profitable way, in a fundamental way, is another. So you want to make sure whatever your focus is, it aligns with company values. Most organizations, large and small, have some kind of stated value statements of somewhere. Think about what you're doing each step along the way. How is this promoting the values of the company? And as a user, as an individual, as well as a partner, we need to all think about the value of what we're giving away. When I log into a free application, you know, there's an old adage, if you're not paying for the product, you are the product, right? So if I'm logging in and I'm getting to use free documents or free communication or free messaging, what is it that I'm giving up? What is the value exchange that's going on? And that has a lot to do with the notion of privacy and usability and trust and several other items. So profit is really not just the raw return. It's actually the mix, the exchange that we get back and forth. And when it comes to people, remember that notion that the sum of the parts are greater, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So the organizations that are successful in creating sustainable IT and sustainable systems empower their people. There are lots and lots of examples of this empowering, whether it's through Netflix or Microsoft or Google or Amazon and all these other places, where they empower people to make their own decisions. They give people guidance on the values and where they want to go, and they say, you show me how to get there. It's also important for those of us who manage IT infrastructure to make sure that we understand that IT is serving and not just demanding. We have lots of experiences in our lives where we have to learn to change our behavior just for a particular piece of software, or just because we installed a new system. Now everyone has to relearn. That's demanding. What we want to do is design systems that serve. So that what happens is we're actually contributing positively to the environment, and that creates more sustainability. It's also very important as consumers to be aware of how labor-saving technology actually works. There are lots of apps out there that will do things like you take a photo of the food on your plate and it will return the caloric value in that photo. Turns out most of those are actually sending a photo to someone in another part of the world who physically looks at it and has to answer the question in a matter of seconds in order to get it back to you. This is labor saving for you, but it's not labor saving for someone else. So it's really important to understand how our technology and how our convenience is affecting other parts of the triple bottom line, where how it's affecting our community, how it's affecting people in one community or another one far away, and how it's even affecting the environment. And then there's this notion that we can learn from the planet as well in our IT systems. And one of the key things that we can learn is to leverage change rather than fighting it. So change itself is super important, but don't try to fight it. Don't try to prevent change. It's not a good idea to be the person in the room that's trying to maintain status quo while things around you are creating pressure to change. That's usually an indicator that change is going to be happening anyway, and you want to take advantage of that. In fact, embrace change. Change is your opportunity for success. The other one is take responsibility for your environment, for the environment you create. And in IT, that means not just the software you're using, make sure that the software that you have is actually respecting the developers, respecting the people who use the software, but also the buyers that you're interacting with, the partners you're interacting with, and the environment you're creating. A great example of this is Bitcoin, for example. Bitcoin is this really intriguing notion, but it's important to understand that it's based, you gain value. The value exchange is I burn energy in order to get some kind of representation of monetary value. And as the system matures, it burns more and more energy. Bitcoin could be one of the key contributors to global warming at some point in the future. We want to be really careful about how what we're doing affects us, those around you, including ourselves. So that really kind of wraps things up. We want to meet the needs of the present. We need to keep operating our business. We don't want to end up like Monolithia where nothing works anymore. We don't want to compromise our future. That means paying attention to people like Conway and Mitra and Papandeep and learning when that last responsible moment is so they don't cut off too many options along the way. Now I want to add a couple of ending notes here just to remind everyone. What's happened in the last few years is that social media has become a big part of the discussion of sustainability, of health, of environment, and of value exchange, and of the role of technology. And in the last several years, I've seen several investor communities start to make the case that social media is not always a good thing, that the value exchange going on there is doing damage. It's a little harder to see than if I'm just polluting in front of my building, if I'm dumping it in some waste pond behind my manufacturing facility, but it can be just as damaging. So we really need to think about this notion of making sure your organization has a social purpose, has in mind some idea of how you're affecting the world around you, both virtually as well as physically. And that happens for all parts of IT as well. So hopefully this gives you some ideas. This gives you some ways to think about this path, this journey up to the peak of Mount Roy. This idea of all of these stories of Monolithia, of the way we treat the static storage, the way we think about how we get jobs done with people and how things change over time. It gives you something to think about when it comes time to navigating your own space, your own Omniterra, the world around you, and how that's important to you. And hopefully this will give you some ideas, and I would be happy to wrap up with a few questions. I think we've got lots of time available, and hopefully we can have some more conversations. So that's what I have. I'm gonna go ahead and flip so that you can at least see me along the way, and then I'd be happy to answer some questions.
Hey, thank you very much. That was an awesome presentation. I really enjoyed that. I had a question around, you brought up a very interesting point with blockchain. When it started off, you look at it, it's like low energy. They start solving these little crypto puzzles. You don't think about the impact. And now it evolves, you know, over whatever time. And it, you know, it becomes, could become a major energy, you know, sucker. Do you right. see this thing happening in a lot of this type of scenario as being more common than that, though? Like, is it sort of a rare one, or is it fairly common?
No, I think it's very, very common. I think especially in the last decade or so, we've seen lots and lots of them. We've been given so many opportunities to be creative and try things out in, you know, at scale. And we don't always think about the consequences. The one that I have often mentioned now in the last year or two has been electric scooters, right? Or bike share systems. So we have this opportunity to create, you know, the low barrier of entry for creating scooter systems, but we don't think about is how these scooters get left around in a city and they actually become clutter. They become littered. Sometimes they become dangerous. The cost of them is so low that people are willing to treat them as disposable items. Bicycles in particular, China experienced this real explosion of bicycles about 10 years ago, where there were lots of, you know, people would just create bikes and you could use one and then just drop it wherever you wanted to go. There are literally mountains and mountains of discarded bicycles all over China. So we have lots of examples of this. And I think one of the challenges we have in front of us is this ability to start lengthening our view, thinking a little bit further in our vision. What's going to happen if I create a rideshare program? What's going to happen if I create a gig economy? What's going to happen if I start just giving these things away? What are people going to be doing with them afterwards? And I think it's an area that is going to be a constant challenge. And that's okay. I mean, that's just part of creating economy, creating value. We just have to think about it in a sustainable way.
If I'm starting a new company or I've got a company and I'm looking at going into sustainability, I want to be sustainable. But at the same time, it's sort of like the angel on one shoulder, the devil on the other. I want to make lots of money. And in all fairness, how can a company start off in a way that can it be profitable? And how do you recommend a company start off?
Yeah, so one of the first things I recommend is actually reading Elkington's Cannibals with Forks. Elking's got some great ideas, and it's been updated several times. I think he wrote the first one in 93, but there have been several editions, and that will lead you to lots of other sources. The second thing I would say goes to that sort of systems thinking part from Donella Meadows. Remember, you're already in a system. You already have software. You already have infrastructure, a delivery mechanism, all this. Start looking for small opportunities to make changes that are positive. How can I improve the environment of the workplace? How can I improve the community? How can I become more effective in delivering product? And just start looking for small opportunities, and they'll start to present you along the way. And always use the measure. Always use that measure of profitability as part of the equation. It's just part of the three-legged stool. We don't, you can't run a not-for-profit organization as the only thing on the planet. We all need profit. We all need exchange in some kind of way. So be prepared to read up, look for opportunities, and then just start trying to find small things in the organization that already exist, that are new opportunities. And in some cases, what you'll find are there actually opportunities for new customers, there are opportunities for new partners, for new outreach, and opportunities to actually become more efficient. Now it's actually cheaper for you to deliver goods than it used to be a year ago. So read up a bit and then start smaller. Those are the two things that I say right away.
We've got a couple more questions. The first one, you mentioned value, profit, and cost. How transparent can we make this for workers versus management?
Oh, that's super good. The short answer is I don't know. I really don't know. I've worked in organizations. I've worked with organizations that are very transparent, all the way to pay scales and outside pay scales to all sorts of reward systems. And I've worked in organizations that are not. I think the big thing to keep in mind is changing that transparency is really, really difficult. So if I work in an organization that has not been transparent, adding transparency is going to be a super, super challenge. If I'm working in a transparent organization and dialing it down in some kind of way, it's going to be super challenging. And I think it's the same thing we talked about before. Look for small opportunities for changing the level of transparency in some kind of ways. And look for ones that make sense. Being transparent, for example, even in a value exchange of postmortems on releases for software, right? So I have lots of organizations that are very secretive about what went wrong in that software release that we just did over the weekend. That's probably an easier thing to change, although some oxes are going to be gored if you suddenly start to publish that my team creates lots of errors and problems every time you release software. I might get upset, right? So I think like everything else, you have to kind of pick away at it and sort of pick your fights. Start small, start simple. Sometimes transparency within a small group is much, much easier than a large group. And then finally, there are lots of regulatory environments where transparency is not going to be allowed in some cases. You can't share certain information. Right, stocks and all sorts of other things. There's lots of regulations in this space. So it's definitely a treacherous place to go. If I remember correctly, I think Elkington has some suggestions on some of that material as well. I'll try to see if I can come up with another reference, especially on this transparency issue, and share it with the ISA global community. I'd be happy to do that.
That'd be really great. We have one other question so far.
Sure.
Or it's a comment, kind of comment question, referring to the mountains of bicycles.
Yes.
Profit organizations don't take the environment into account, especially in non-regulated environments. And so I'm assuming this is a question about regulated versus non-regulated environments, and how do we actually factor in the environment if it's not costed in?
So that's all that comes up quite a bit. That's actually a great example. And I picked the China and the bikes, but we can all talk about all sorts of things, all sorts of plastics in the US, paper bags and everything, right? It's always a situation. So costing in is always is a very powerful element. If you think about it, costing in is changing the value exchange, right? So it turns out it's going to be more costly for me to manufacture an item that can't be broken down and recycled, right? Now, sometimes those costs are indirect. In other words, it's not costly to me as a producer. It's only costly to some other part of the system, right? And when you think in a systems term, then if we're all part of the same system, then we share costs. But most of us don't think about it that way. There's a lot of distance, both time and space, between where the cost is incurred and where the cost is paid. So taxing systems and regulatory systems try to move where that exchange happens. So it turns out, if I buy goods from outside the country and that deteriorates the internal environment for business in my own country, then I might have to pay a tariff, right? So we have lots and lots of these examples. So I think it's a matter of starting to balance the notion of where I want to move the exchange, where I want to place this. And sometimes that will mean some tariffs. Now, the other thing that I think, I'm not a policy maker, right? And I've only had a chance to talk to policymakers in various forums. But one of the things that I learned over and over again is often, like everything else, we have to be careful about creating really gigantic sort of structures. You need to try to create structures that scale well. So I think it's a matter of moving exchange. Environment is just one of those exchanges. And that's where this idea of balancing comes to play. And tariffs or taxes or some other kind of cost, imposition is happening in all sorts of places, even inside companies. So I work in companies where they actually have a cost model for IT. If you're going to be using our database storage, you're going to be paying a cost. You're going to be paying in to the actual budget of the data storage system. So there are lots of examples of that, and I think we need to be persistent and creative and work on ways to move the exchange of value to different places. Hope that helps. I'm not really sure.